Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst. We are here today for a really exhaustive deep dive into a single massive source, the Washington Post, for Saturday, October 25th, 2025.
That's right. And our mission really is to take this stack of articles, this snapshot of one day, and unpack what it tells us about the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because this paper, it captures a world grappling with some really aggressive foreign policy moves. Escalating legal fights at home, rising costs hitting everyone.
Yeah.
And underlying it all, this kind of crisis of trust. Trust in institutions, trust in the rules. It seems to be everywhere.
It really does. That's the threat, isn't it? Escalation. You see it militarily, legally, economically. Even culturally, you could argue it's like the limits are being pushed everywhere.
So where do we start, I guess, with the most immediate kinetic example?
I think we have to. The military escalation in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
The anti-narcotics campaign.
Okay, let's get right into it. Because the scale is just, well, it's huge. The Pentagon sending the USS Gerald R. Ford.
The world's largest aircraft carrier.
Exactly. To Latin America. That's an enormous projection of power.
It absolutely is. And, you know, the official line is disrupting narcotics trafficking. Degrading and dismantling criminal groups. That's the quote.
But sending a supercarrier, I mean, that feels like more than just chasing speedboats, right?
Oh, absolutely. A carrier strike group like the Fords, it's designed for high-intensity conventional warfare. Putting that in the Caribbean, where it joins an already significant naval presence, well, it signals something far beyond standard drug patrols.
And it's happening alongside what the Post calls highly provocative rhetoric from the President and Defense Secretary Hegseth.
Mm-hmm. And they've already been acting on it. Destroying speedboats, killing the occupants. What are the numbers?
43 confirmed deaths since early September across just 10 attacks. That's a lot.
It is. And the President's rhetoric suggests it's not stopping there. He apparently indicated the land is next.
The land is next. What does that even mean in this context? Striking drug labs.
That seems to be the implication. Potentially across borders.
Yeah.
Venezuela is often mentioned.
Which connects to the other narrative, doesn't it? The administration has already called Nicolas Maduro an illegitimate leader.
Right. So the speculation, and it's widespread among analysts in the piece, is that this anti-drug campaign might be, you know, convenient cover. Cover for potentially destabilizing or even forcibly removing Maduro.
And Maduro sees it that way, too. He accused the U.S. of inventing a new eternal war.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the absolute crux of it, the point that really defines the clash here. The legality.
Yeah, the article mentions legal experts.
Overwhelmingly. Experts in the laws of war, they reject the administration's justification, flat out.
Why? What's the argument?
They argue these strikes are illegal under international law. Because the people being killed are involved in essentially illicit commercial activity. It's crime, right? Smuggling.
So law enforcement, not military action.
Exactly. It should be handled through arrests, prosecution, not drone strikes, or naval gunnery, treating them like enemy combatants in an armed conflict with the United States.
But the administration is trying to frame it that way, as an armed conflict.
Yes. They're using terms like narco-terrorists and trying to designate this as a non-international armed conflict, which is a very specific legal term.
So they're trying to redefine drug smugglers, who we've always treated as criminals, as what? Combatants like Al-Qaeda?
That's precisely the comparison Defense Secretary Hegseth made. We'll get to that quote. But yeah, it's a fundamental shift in legal posture.
And the sheer size of the fleet down there backs up the idea that this isn't just symbolic. The Ford is joining. What else is there?
It's an armada. Destroyers like the USS Jason Dunham. Okay, that's standard. But also the three-ship Iwo Jima Amphibious Ready Group.
Amphibious Ready Group. That sounds serious.
It is, because it carries Marines. Hundreds of infantry Marines from the 22nd Marine Expeditionary Unit, the MEU.
And MEUs are trained for?
Rapid response, amphibious assaults, special operations support. They're intervention forces. Designed for putting boots on the ground, potentially, not just patrolling the seas.
Wow.
And there's more. The fleet includes the MV Ocean Trader.
What's that?
It's basically a floating base used by elite special operations forces. So you put all that together, a supercarrier, amphibious assault ships with Marines, a special ops base ship. This isn't deterrence. It looks like an intervention force poised for action.
And Secretary Hegseth, you mentioned his rhetoric. He doubled down.
He did. Announcing the latest strike, the one that killed six more people, bringing the total to at least 43. He explicitly said, and this is the quote, If you are a narco-terrorist smuggling drugs in our hemisphere, we will treat you like we treat Al-Qaeda.
There it is, treating drug smugglers like Al-Qaeda.
It's a calculated line. It's meant to provide that legal justification, that cover, for what many see as extrajudicial killings.
But you mentioned something earlier about survivors. That suggests they know the legal ground is shaky?
Exactly. Another fascinating detail in the reporting. A previous strike apparently left two survivors. Now, if the administration truly believed these people were combatants under this narco-terrorist idea,
they'd detain them, right? Like prisoners of war or unlawful combatants?
You'd think so. Indefinitely, maybe. But they didn't. They repatriated them, sent them back.
Yeah.
Which suggests, tactically, they realized they didn't actually have the legal authority to hold them as enemies in an armed conflict. They kind of blinked.
So they adjusted tactics but kept the lethal strikes going. That's revealing.
It highlights the internal tension, the legal tightrope they're walking. And this whole situation is causing massive diplomatic waves, obviously. Look at Colombia.
Right. The sanctions. The Treasury Department sanctioned Colombian President Gustavo Petro.
And his wife, Veronica, his son, Nicholas, and the Interior Minister, Armando Benedetti. It's personal.
And reason given, failing to stop drug production.
Yeah. The Treasury Secretary claimed drug production has exploded under Petro, and he's failed demonstrably to stop it.
But Petro's reaction? He called it a paradox.
He did. Because, I mean, Colombia has been a key U.S. partner in the drug war for decades, right? Mm-hmm. And Petro himself has been the most vocal critic in Latin America of these recent U.S. strikes. He called them murder.
So the sanctions look less like they're about drug stats.
And more like political punishment. That's what the analysts in the article suggest. It's sending a clear message. Fall in line with U.S. policy or face the consequences. It's the cost of dissent.
And what about checks and balances back here? Congress, intelligence oversight.
Seems to be completely missing in action, or at least sidelined. The top Democrats on the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, that's Jim Himes and Mark Warner, they've formally demanded details from the DNI, Tulsi Gabbard.
Because they're not getting briefed?
They say they've received virtually no information about the spy agency's role in all this. They're questioning the legality, especially this whole non-international armed conflict designation the administration is using.
Is that designation controversial?
Very. Usually that requires a certain level of organized, sustained violence. Think civil war, right? Many experts argue these fragmented drug cartels just don't meet that threshold to legally justify military force under the laws of war.
And there's even pushback from within the military.
That's another key point from the reporting. Committee staff are apparently hearing from inside the Pentagon that junior officers are getting nervous. They're asking military lawyers for written sign-offs before participating in these lethal strikes because they're worried about their own legal liability down the line.
Wow. That's significant. When the people ordered to pull the trigger are asking for legal cover.
It signals deep institutional unease about the legality of the orders. But politically, there's a vacuum. The Republicans in Congress. Many who pushed back against the president's military actions before, like the Soleimani strike in Iran back in 2020, they're mostly silent now.
Really? Why the change?
Well, the sources suggest partisan alignment. Only two Republican senators, Rand Paul and Lisa Murkowski, voted to block these Caribbean attacks.
Just two.
Yeah. And Rand Paul had that quote suggesting the GOP is basically against emergencies when there's a Democrat president, but for emergencies when there's a Republican president.
So political deference is allowing this campaign, which, again, many experts call illegal, to just escalate without any real checks.
That seems to be the situation. It sets a really dangerous precedent for executive overreach in using military force.
Okay, so that's the Caribbean situation. Huge. Let's connect this to the wider world. The Post also touches on Russia and China, right?
It does. Two interesting points. First, on dealing with Putin. There's insight from Mikhail Khodorkovsky.
The exiled oligarch who Putin jailed for years.
Exactly. And his advice is pretty blunt. He says, forget sanctions on big oil companies like Rosneft or Lukoil. Putin doesn't care about that personally.
So what does he care about?
Direct personal pressure. Khodorkovsky points to one thing that did seem to get Putin's attention. The threat of the U.S. supplying Ukraine with Tomahawk cruise missiles.
Why Tomahawk specifically?
Their range. They could easily reach Moscow. Khodorkovsky says this registered as a direct personal threat to Putin and his inner circle. He called it feeling like a hunt against you and your entourage. For a leader like Putin, apparently that personal risk is the only language that cuts through.
Fascinating. Okay, and the other point, Taiwan.
Yeah, shifting to Asia, there's an editorial focusing on the president's visit to Japan. And the big underlying anxiety, sort of below the radar, is Taiwan.
Japan is worried the U.S. might soften its stance.
Deeply worried. Japanese Prime Minister Sanata Kaichi is apparently very unsettled by signs the U.S. might trade away security commitments to Taiwan for, say, a better trade deal with China's President Xi Jinping.
What signs?
Well, the administration halted a $400 million arms package to Taiwan recently. They discouraged a visit by Taiwan's president, Lai Ching-te. And maybe most alarmingly, the U.S. president actually accused Taiwan of stealing the U.S. semiconductor industry.
That doesn't sound like a strong commitment.
Not at all. And for Japan, this is existential. Taiwan is less than 70 miles from Japanese islands.
Right. If China took Taiwan, Japan is suddenly on the front line.
Exactly. A new Cold War, right on their doorstep. The editorial suggests Japan needs an unequivocal U.S. commitment to defend Taiwan, and maybe even needs to pressure the U.S., kind of like European allies did successfully over Ukraine policy.
So allies can't just assume U.S. protection anymore. They have to actively lobby for it.
That seems to be the message. It's a very unstable picture globally.
Okay, let's pivot from global tensions to the battlegrounds right here at home. Because the sources paint a picture of, well, similar tactics being used domestically. Weaponizing institutions, targeting opponents.
Absolutely. There's a clear strategy outlined in the reporting. Using federal power, sometimes obscure legal tools, against perceived political enemies.
And the prime example seems to be the indictment of New York Attorney General Letitia James.
Yes, she's the highest-ranking Democrat indicted in this administration's push to prosecute foes. She just pleaded not guilty in Norfolk federal court on Friday to mortgage fraud charges. Trial's set for January 26.
Mortgage fraud? What are the specifics?
It revolves around a house she bought in Norfolk back in 2020, a three-bedroom place. The allegation is she signed what's called a second home rider on her mortgage.
What's that?
It usually gets you better terms, like a lower interest rate, because the bank assumes you'll be using the house personally sometimes, making it less risky than a pure rental property.
Okay.
But the indictment claims she immediately rented it out, treated it purely as an investment property, making her a landlord, not just a second homeowner. And they allege she stood to make over $18,000 in ill-gotten gains because of those better mortgage terms.
All right, on the surface, that sounds like, well, potentially mortgage fraud, but what's the political angle?
It's huge. James's lawyers are moving to dismiss the whole case, arguing it's vindictive prosecution.
Yeah.
Purely political payback for her investigations into the president.
And they're targeting the prosecutor.
Specifically, the interim U.S. attorney handling the case, Lindsey Halligan. They want her disqualified. Mm-hmm. Because she's a White House political appointee. She has no prior prosecution experience. And crucially, she apparently took over the case after career prosecutors in that office had reviewed the evidence and decided not to charge James, finding insufficient grounds.
Oh, that looks bad.
It feeds directly into the political hit job narrative. It suggests the case was revived purely for political reasons, bypassing normal prosecutorial judgment.
And this tactic, going after mortgage records, the article suggests it's a broader threat.
Yes, a potential threat to much of the D.C. establishment, really. The administration, with the Federal Housing Finance Agency director, Bill Polt, seemingly leading the charge, has been digging into these records.
Targeting officials with multiple homes.
Exactly. Officials who might claim more than one property as a primary residence or use those second home riders. The Post mentions 41 House members and 26 senators have disclosed multiple mortgages.
Now, having multiple mortgages isn't illegal.
No, of course not. But the use of these private financial records by political allies to publicly attack opponents like James or Senator Adam Schiff or Fed Governor Lisa Cook, it suggests federal agencies are being wielded as weapons. Additional pressure points, as the article puts it, to ensure loyalty or punish dissent.
It's chilling.
Okay.
Another major domestic conflict. The National Guard in D.C.
Right. A huge constitutional clash playing out. The D.C. Attorney General is suing to stop the deployment of 2,500 Guard members currently stationed in the Capitol.
On what grounds?
They're arguing it violates the Posse Comitatus Act.
Remind us what that is.
It's a really important law that generally prevents the federal military from being used for domestic law enforcement, keeps the military separate from civilian policing.
And the argument is that because these Guard troops are under the president's command,
they effectively function as federal military forces being used domestically, which triggers the act's restrictions. D.C. argues the president needs clear guardrails on this power.
How does the administration respond?
Aggressively. Their lawyers argue D.C. is constitutionally unique, a unique creature with zero sovereignty. Basically, they claim the president has almost unlimited power to deploy troops in the district as he sees fit.
Unlimited? Did they give any limits?
Apparently not really. During court arguments, the administration's lawyers struggled to name any specific limit on how the president could use the guard in D.C. That lack of restraint is what worries people.
And this deployment led to that bizarre incident with the Star Wars music.
Yeah, the protest by D.C. resident Sam O'Hara. He followed an Ohio National Guard patrol playing the Imperial March, you know, Darth Vader's theme, on his phone.
And they detained him.
Detained and handcuffed him. He's now suing, claiming it violated his First Amendment right to protest and his Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable seizure.
It sounds absurd, but it highlights the tension when you have military patrols interacting with civilian protesters.
Exactly. And the Army's internal communications, mentioned in the article, suggest troops might stay until the America 250 celebrations in 2026. So this temporary deployment is starting to feel pretty permanent.
This theme of national policy having harsh local impacts. We see it with immigration too, right?
Yes, a really striking example. The administration launched this crackdown in Chicago called Operation Midway Blitz.
Okay.
And they tried to use the tragic story of Katie Abraham, who was killed by an undocumented immigrant driver, as the face of the campaign.
But her mother objected.
Strongly. Denise Lawrence publicly rebuked the administration. She said her daughter would not have wanted to be associated with a campaign that targets Chicago.
Wow, that's powerful. Rejecting the political use of her daughter's death.
It really undermines the administration's attempt to claim the moral high ground for the operation.
And then there's disaster aid, FEMA.
Another example that looks very transactional, very political.
Right.
The administration denied Maryland's appeal for federal disaster aid.
For flood damage.
Yeah, over $33.7 million in damage in Allegheny and Garrett counties. And the damage clearly exceeded the normal thresholds where FEMA aid kicks in.
So why deny it?
Well, look at who did get aid. The president posted messages congratulating Missouri, Nebraska, Alaska, North Dakota.
And explicitly linked it to politics.
Oh, yes. Boasting things like, I won the Show Me State 3 times, and it is my honor to deliver for these incredible patriots. The implication is pretty clear. Aid flows to states that show political loyalty.
And the real-world impact in Maryland.
The mayor of Lona Coning, one of the flooded towns, is deeply worried. People lost their furnaces in the floods. Winter is coming. Without federal help, elderly residents might not have heat. It connects political decisions directly to basic survival.
Even architecture isn't safe from this conflict. The White House East Wing.
Right. The demolition is underway. To make space for the president's plan, get this, 90,000 square foot ballroom.
90,000 square feet? That's enormous.
Twice the size of the main White House residence building. And tearing down the historic East Wing to do it. Well, it's become a tourist attraction, but also a source of real outrage.
Tramu.
Preservationists, political critics. Former First Lady Hillary Clinton is quoted accusing the president of destroying history that belongs to the public.
And this affects things like the White House Christmas decorations.
Well, the tour will still happen, apparently, but the route has changed. Because the East Colonnade, which was famous for decorations like Melania Trump's red trees, it just doesn't exist anymore. It's gone.
And there's a fight over the space shuttle, too, at the Smithsonian.
Yeah, another clash between politics and preservation, or maybe expertise. Texas legislators are accusing the Smithsonian of potentially illegal lobbying.
Why?
Because the Smithsonian shared its concerns, and the estimated cost $120 to $150 million of moving the space shuttle Discovery from its museum near D.C. down to Texas, as mandated by a recent bill.
What are the concerns?
That the move itself, 1,300 miles, would require dismantling the shuttle, particularly breaking apart its delicate, irreplaceable heat-shielding tiles. Critics say it would render the historic artifact basically unusable for future study or display.
So again, it feels like a political decision, potentially overriding expert warnings about damaging a national treasure.
That's the pattern, isn't it?
Okay.
Should we shift gears to the economy?
Mm-hmm.
Because consumers are definitely feeling the pressure.
Yes, let's do that. Especially with the government shutdown limiting data. What do we actually know about inflation?
Well, we got one key report, September's Consumer Price Index, the CPI. It showed prices rising at a 3% annual rate.
How does that compare?
It's up a tiny bit from August, which was 2.9%. It's still significantly above the low point we saw back in April, which was 2.3%. So inflation isn't really going away. It seems stuck.
What's keeping it around 3%?
Mostly services. The price of services rose 3.6% year over year. And the biggest chunk of that is shelter. Housing costs. That hits everyone's budget hard.
Anything else?
Yeah, prices for goods that are subject to tariffs also went up. Things like apparel, furniture.
So what does this mean for the Federal Reserve? Are they going to keep hiking rates?
Probably not hike. Actually, economists think this slightly lower than expected number gives the Fed room to cut rates again next week. It would be the second cut this year.
But if inflation is still near 3%,
they'll likely go slow. They won't cut aggressively while inflation is still this sticky. As one economist put it, they're just easing off the brake a bit, not slamming the accelerator.
Okay. And this inflation number directly impacts Social Security, right? The COLA.
Exactly. The cost of living adjustment for next year is based on this data. It's going to be 2.8%.
2.8%. That sounds, okay, close to the 3% inflation rate.
On the surface, yes. But here's the problem. It lags way behind the cost increases for things older adults spend the most on.
Like what?
Medical care costs, up 4%. Electricity, up 5%. Natural gas, piped gas for heating, up a massive 11.7%.
Ouch. So a 2.8% COLA means seniors are actually falling further behind on essentials.
Precisely. Their purchasing power for necessities is actually shrinking. It's a real financial squeeze.
And that squeeze is being compounded by health insurance costs, especially on the ACA marketplaces.
Oh, massively. This is a huge story. Premiums for the most popular plans on healthcare.gov are set to jump by an average of 30% next year.
30%? That's enormous.
It's the biggest annual increase since, I think, 2018, when it was 37%. This affects potentially 17 million Americans.
And this is happening just as those extra pandemic subsidies are likely ending.
Exactly. That's the subsidy cliff everyone talks about. You've got the huge premium spike hitting right as the enhanced financial help expires. For millions of people, especially those with slightly higher incomes, their monthly payments could literally double or triple in 2026.
Who loses the subsidies completely?
Anyone earning above 400% of the federal poverty level, that's around $72,000 for an individual. They lose all financial assistance. Suddenly, coverage could become completely unaffordable.
And this is tied up in the government shutdown fight.
Absolutely central. Democrats want to extend the enhanced subsidies. Republicans argue they were always meant to be temporary and need to end.
What do the insurance companies say?
They're blaming rising drug costs, hospital costs, general medical inflation. And they're anticipating that healthier people will drop coverage because of the price hikes, which makes the remaining pool of customers sicker and more expensive, which... Well, it justifies raising premiums even more next year. It's a death spiral.
Driven by political gridlock. Wow.
Okay, one more economic item. Canada. Trade talks collapsed.
Abruptly canceled by the president late Thursday night.
Over what? Tariffs? Dairy?
Lumber?
Nope. Over a Canadian anti-tariff advertisement.
An ad? Seriously?
Seriously. An ad paid for by the government of Ontario, led by Premier Doug Ford. It featured audio clips from a 1987 radio address by Ronald Reagan.
Reagan, criticizing tariffs.
Yes. Reagan warning about the dangers of protectionism. The president apparently saw the ad, got furious, accused Canada of using a fraudulent fake ad, even though the quotes were accurate, and boom, canceled the talks.
What did Reagan actually say in the ad?
He warned that high tariffs lead to retaliation, trigger trade wars, and ultimately cause markets shrink and collapse. Businesses and industries shut down, and millions of people lose their jobs. Classic Reagan free trade arguments.
The irony is staggering.
Completely. The opinion piece in the Post nailed it, calling it the pettiest reason to derail talks with Canada.
What does this mean for Canada?
Well, they send 3/4 of their exports to the U.S. This kind of volatility, this unreliability, it's forcing them to seriously look elsewhere, to diversify their trade partnerships because they just can't count on the U.S. market being stable or rational.
Another foundational relationship being frayed. Okay, let's move to science, health, and culture. There was some really exciting news about mRNA vaccines.
Yes, potentially game-changing. A retrospective study looked at advanced lung and skin cancer patients who were already getting immunotherapy.
Okay.
And it found that those who also happened to get an mRNA COVID vaccine seemed to have a massively boosted immune response against their cancer.
How boosted?
Their median survival length nearly doubled. For the lung cancer patients, it went from about 20.6 months to 37.3 months. That's huge.
Wow. How does it work? What's the theory?
Scientists think the foreign RNA from the vaccine acts like a general alarm, a 9/11 signal for the immune system. It wakes everything up, including the T cells that were being held back from attacking the cancer. It basically releases the brakes.
So the vaccine platform itself, not necessarily the COVID part, could be used to supercharge cancer treatments.
That's the potential.
Yeah.
An off-the-shelf immune booster using the mRNA platform. But the timing, it's difficult. Because HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. just announced the government is cutting nearly $500 million in funding for mRNA vaccine development.
On what grounds?
He claimed they don't protect well enough against upper respiratory infections, a claim most scientists strongly dispute, especially given this kind of potential for cancer and other diseases.
So a major potential breakthrough is hitting a political wall.
It seems that way. This study, using real-world patient data from MD Anderson, really highlights how adaptable and powerful the mRNA platform is. Researchers called it incredibly adaptable and easy to work with. The hope is this survival data forces a rethink on the funding cuts.
Let's hope so. Okay, shifting from medicine to ancient history. Dinosaurs.
Yeah, a cool finding about the extinction event. New dating techniques used on rocks in New Mexico are refining the timeline.
What did they find?
They found that a really diverse range of dinosaurs were still thriving just 340,000 years before the asteroid hit.
Why is that significant?
Because it pushes back against the older theory that dinosaurs were already in a slow decline for millions of years before the impact. This suggests they were doing fine, and the asteroid was truly a sudden, decisive knockout punch to a healthy ecosystem.
Interesting. Okay, back to health, but this time legal and ethical issues. A lawsuit in Michigan.
Yes, over a state law concerning pregnant patients and advance directives. You know, living wills.
What's the issue?
Michigan has this old law that basically voids a pregnant patient's advance directive if she becomes incapacitated. Her chosen advocate, her healthcare proxy, is legally barred from withdrawing life-sustaining treatment, even if her directive explicitly said no life support.
Even if she specifically requested it.
Yes. The lawsuit, brought by 9 residents, including doctors, argues this violates the patient's autonomy and Michigan's recently reinstated constitutional right to reproductive freedom.
Has this kind of situation actually happened?
Yes. There was a highly publicized case in Georgia where a brain-dead pregnant woman was kept on life support for months against her stated wishes just to maintain the pregnancy. The Michigan doctors suing say they don't want to be forced to do that, violating their ethics and the patient's rights.
A real clash between state law and individual autonomy. Okay, now something cultural. People actively avoiding AI. AI abstainers.
Yeah, it's a growing counter-movement. Some students, workers, artists are consciously choosing not to use AI tools.
Why? What are the concerns?
A whole range. Accuracy issues, the environmental cost of running these massive models, privacy worries, built-in biases, and also just the feeling that it undermines their own skills and learning process.
Like the student mentioned, Ellen Rugeberg.
Right, the 16-year-old who said relying on AI means you don't learn how to do the work yourself. And professionals are finding practical problems too.
Such as?
Software engineers finding that AI code generators often make subtle errors that take more time to fix than writing the code correctly in the first place.
But it's hard to speak up.
Apparently so. There's pressure to adopt these tools, and raising problems can make you seem like a Luddite, like you're resistant to progress, even if the concerns are valid.
And some businesses are taking a stand.
Yeah, small ones mostly. Like the Stork Club Music Venue, they have a not by AI policy for their concert posters. They see human-made art as part of the creative process, something essential, something not very punk to just automate away. It's about valuing human input.
That commitment to the authentic, the human-made, it kind of connects to this wild story about live college mascots, doesn't it?
It really does. It's this incredible niche world. About 24 universities still use live animal mascots.
And it's a serious operation.
Oh, incredibly serious. Huge amounts of time, dedication from student handler teams, and significant money. Colorado's Ralphie the Bison, her program costs nearly $100,000 a year.
$100,000 for a running bison? That's amazing. How do they even handle a bison?
Very carefully. Ralphie the 7th, the current one, was chosen for her calm temperament. The handlers acclimated her to the stadium noise by literally sitting with her, singing classic rock songs, giving her head rubs, and feeding her special treats called cow cakes.
Singing classic rock to a bison. Okay, what about other mascots? Bevo the Longhorn?
Bevo X Viff from Texas is a huge brand now. He appears at presidential inaugurations, weddings, funerals. His appearances and merchandise help raise about $200,000 a year for charity. And when he retires, he gets fancy custom oats and molasses.
Living the good life. What about Tusk the Boar from Arkansas?
Tusk 6, apparently loves vanilla birthday cake. Gets grapes after touchdowns. When they look for a new Tusk, they want one with an outgoing personality. Not too mean, not too crazy. They acclimate the new guy by playing an old radio in his barn.
And Uga the bulldog from Georgia.
Uga Beksu is basically trained as a good house pet. His family owns the lineage and keeps it pretty low-key. They generally turn down requests for private events like bar mitzvahs or mall openings, sticking mostly to official university functions. It's all about tradition and identity.
Amazing dedication. Okay, from college traditions to pro sports, where tradition and integrity seem to be taking a huge hit, the NBA gambling scandal.
Yeah, it completely overshadowed the start of the season. Just a massive blow.
Who got arrested?
High-profile names. Portland Trailblazers coach Chauncey Billups charged with money laundering and wire fraud conspiracy. And Miami Heat guard Terry Rozier, conspiracy to commit wire fraud.
What's the allegation? Fixing games.
Passing insider information to bettors. The FBI says at least seven NBA games in 2023 and 2024 were compromised by this scheme, leaking info about player availability, injuries, things that could sway betting lines.
It just ruins the integrity, doesn't it? Makes you wonder if the betting odds matter more than the game itself.
That's exactly the fear. Charles Barkley had some strong words about it. As a known bettor himself, he disagreed it was about addiction. Just called the people involved stupid for trying to fix games when they already make so much money.
And the media coverage must be awkward, especially for ESPN.
Incredibly awkward. ESPN's the league's broadcast partner, right? They were covering the press conference announcing the arrests while literally running commercials for their own sportsbook, ESPN Bet.
Oof. It's a conflict.
A massive one. The initial coverage was apparently a bit clumsy, focusing on speculation. But later reports did get into the details, explaining how leaking that inside info could actually manipulate the betting markets. It's a real crisis for the league.
Any other sports news quickly?
Yeah, a few things. American gymnast Donald Wittenberg won gold on the steel rings at the World Championships, first ever for the U.S. in that event.
Great. NFL.
Commanders receiver Terry McLaurin looks set to return after a quad injury. But 49ers QB Brock Purdy is still out with that toe injury, missing his fourth straight game.
Okay. And some non-sports global items. Brazil.
Serious public health issue there. Officials are investigating deadly tainted liquor. The theory is criminals added methanol, basically industrial alcohol, to drinks like cachaça to boost volume and profits.
Methanol, that's incredibly dangerous.
Deadly. At least 10 deaths confirmed. And it's spreading fear, even in upscale areas, causing legitimate spirit sales to plummet.
And Iceland. Mosquitoes fake.
Yeah. A real sign of the times. Iceland has always been famous for having no mosquitoes. But they've now spotted their first ones, Kilisera and Yolata.
Where did they come from?
They're common in Europe and seem to be adapting to colder climates. Scientists directly link their appearance in Iceland to rising global temperatures. A climate change indicator showing up in a place you'd never expect.
Wow. Okay, let's wrap up with some of the opinion pieces and advice columns, as they often reflect these broader themes.
They really do. We already touched on the piece calling the candid trade talk cancellation petty.
Right. What else? There was something comparing different kinds of censorship.
Yeah, a professor made an interesting distinction. MAGA censorship, which they defined as external governmental pressure, threatening funding, trying to suppress speech from the outside.
Versus
woke censorship, described more as internal academic peer pressure, social consequences within the institution for saying the wrong thing. The argument was that the external government censorship is constitutionally worse, a bigger threat to free speech principles.
But there was a twist.
A paradoxical one. The professor suggested that maybe, just maybe, facing that external threat could actually unify academics, forcing them to rediscover and defend core principles like free inquiry that they might have started taking for granted when the pressure was only internal.
Interesting thought. And the piece on democracy's crisis.
That one talked about entering the post-referee age, meaning trust in institutions, courts, media, government, the traditional referees of facts and fairness has fallen so low that people don't believe in neutrality anymore.
So what do they prefer?
According to the article, they now prefer ferocious partisans who are honest about their bias, who openly reject the system's pretense of impartiality, over perceived hypocrites claiming neutrality. Authenticity, even aggressive partisan authenticity, becomes more valued than a neutrality nobody trusts.
That feels very relevant to everything we've discussed. And finally, the relationship advice. Carolyn Hacks.
A perfect microcosm of the trust and accountability issue. A woman wrote in, furious with herself for waiting over a year to confront her boyfriend about hitting on her friends because she was scared of his temper.
And when she finally did,
he exploded at her, got furious that she waited so long to bring it up.
Turning it back on her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hax identified it as classic gaslighting. He used his anger to flood the room, change the subject, make her the bad guy, and completely avoid any accountability for his own behavior hitting on her friends.
And that pattern, using outrage to dodge responsibility.
We see echoes of it everywhere, don't we? In politics, in justifications for questionable actions.
Right.
It's a tactic used when trust is broken and accountability is avoided.
So pulling this all together, this one Saturday edition of the Washington Post, it's a portrait of foundations being shaken, isn't it?
Absolutely. Military norms, legal frameworks, trade relationships, institutional trust, even physical structures like the East Wing. Everything seems to be under stress, being actively dismantled or aggressively tested.
The sheer volume of conflict, as you said at the start, the carrier in the Caribbean, the guard in D.C., the sanctions, the court battles, the fights over science funding and history.
It really feels like we're living through a moment where the established rules, the norms we thought were stable, are being fundamentally reevaluated, often under extreme pressure. The rule book is being rewritten or maybe just ignored in real time.
And what strikes me most is the fragility, the uncertainty. Is this military strike legal? Is our trade partner reliable? Will this amazing scientific platform survive political interference? Everything feels conditional, contingent, volatile.
Which brings us right back to that idea from the opinion pages, the post-referee age. If you, the listener, feel like you're living in that age, where maybe you doubt the impartiality of almost every institution, the courts, the media, the government, then the really challenging question becomes, what pillars do you still believe in? What fundamental principles of fairness, of objective reality, are non-negotiable and worth fighting to keep fair, and maybe even harder? How do you even begin to rebuild trust when simple transparency often seems to just fuel more cynicism?
That is a huge question to grapple with, a really profound thought to leave us with as we try to make sense of all this. Thank you for navigating us through this incredibly dense and frankly unsettling snapshot of our world.
It's always valuable to dive deep like this, Lee. A pleasure.
And thank you all for joining us for the deep dive. We'll talk to you next time.